And that's what we want him to do, isn't it? Hebrews chapter 11 at verse 20 gives the Hall of Fame summary for Isaac. It's pretty short. By faith, Isaac blessed Jacob and Esau, even regarding things to come. You know, Abraham last week, such an exciting person to talk about, goes out on this journey without any real direction, just a command, and does some foolish things, but for the most part, pretty amazing follower, exciting story. And then Isaac, and then Jacob. Jacob, you know, a lot of it is crazy things that he does. Totally off the wall, deceiver that he was. But lots of drama, and so much took place around his life all the way to basically the end of Genesis. But Isaac, in between those two, not a lot of excitement. And what we have about him isn't really all that positive in many ways. And so I find him two things. One, kind of difficult to study, and two, pretty easy to identify with, because I think myself, along with some humans at least, find ourselves feeling kind of intimidated by characters that just seem to have all the drama and life and impact, and a lot of us don't feel that way. And yet God guided the writer of Hebrews to include Isaac in that Hall of Fame. And it would be interesting to know just what all the Spirit of God put in that writer's mind when he wrote, by faith, Isaac blessed Jacob and Esau, even regarding things to come. And so I thought it would be good to just kind of review Isaac's life and get to know him better, but probably with the focus on the fact that in the line of the Jewish nation, Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, and on from there, Isaac fulfilled his place, and he's listed in the Hebrews Hall of Fame as a man of faith. And I think we can all hang on to that and identify with that and appreciate that journey. You'd have to read all the way from Genesis 21 through chapter 35 to get all the mentions of Isaac during his lifetime. And then, of course, he's mentioned over and over again in the Bible, because often they're listed, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, as kind of the trio of those early warriors and leaders of the Jewish nation. During his first 40 years, there's a few key things to remember. His birth in 21:3, his dad was 100 years old, and his mom was 90. But if you consider the fact that his dad lived to be, I think, 185, double or so of what most people live today, then maybe it was more like 50 and 40 or 45 by today's standards when Isaac was born. But obviously it was the end of a long journey of waiting, and finally God blessed Isaac and Rebecca, or Abraham and Sarah with Isaac, and prepared him for his future with Rebecca. There's also sibling rivalry. Chapter 21, verse 9, talks about this half-brother Ishmael. And you remember the story, we just alluded to it last week, that Abraham got anxious. He's supposed to be having descendants that you can't count, and he doesn't have his first one. And Sarah's getting anxious, and she realizes she's past the age of being able to have a child. And so they followed a cultural custom. And I think that's so relevant to today, because many followers of Jesus today on planet Earth are following cultural customs, and they're not biblical. In fact, they're totally unbiblical. They're sinful. And so they followed this custom that if you couldn't have a child, you could have somebody else have the child for you. And so they had this Egyptian young lady, servant, and Abraham had a child by her, Ishmael. And Abraham, I think, was convinced that he and Sarah had helped God out. put in the bottom of your notes, God does not ask us to for our help to get his work accomplished. He desires our submission to his will. And the Bible is full of characters, illustrations of people that are trying to help God out. And if you've lived a few years in your Christian life and you're honest, you probably with me will admit that there have been times in your life that you tried to help God out with something, and he reminded us that he really didn't need our help at all. He just needed us to follow him and trust him and do it his way. And so there's sibling rivalry, and as near as I can tell, Ishmael was about 14 years older than young Isaac. And so that caused some problems, and I think indicates that there was plenty of dysfunction in that home. Earlier, obviously, there was, because after Hagar, the servant lady, got pregnant, then there was jealousy between her and Sarah, and they ran her off for a while and then took her back. And now that Isaac has arrived, Sarah's son, the true son, the son of promise, now there's a problem between the half-brothers. And at whatever age Isaac was, I don't know when they had that special ceremony. There's a lot of debate about how old a child was when they had that celebration. But whenever it was, Ishmael, the older half-brother, was apparently making fun of Isaac. And Sarah went kind of ballistic on that one. And so they chased Hagar and Ishmael out of the house, and they went on their own journey. That had to be a traumatic experience for Isaac, don't you think? I think it was traumatic for Abraham. There's no real record in the account during those 13, 14 years that Abraham and Ishmael were doing life together. And I think they were bonding. I think they were playing. I think they were developing a great father-son connection. And that Abraham had just kind of convinced himself that he had helped God out. And here's the boy that's going to be the boy of promise. And then God says, Abraham, that isn't the way it's going to be. I told you, you and Rebekah would have a son, and they did. So now that Isaac's on the scene, Ishmael is a problem, and that had to cause a lot of drama. And I believe that had an impact on Isaac. It certainly would on someone today. And so Ishmael and his mom depart the scene, and the focus is on Isaac, the true son of promise. And then also during those first 40 years is the Moriah event. And I want to bring that back as we approach communion today, because I think Isaac is an Old Testament picture, really, of what Jesus did for us. But that had to be pretty traumatic. This young man, we don't know how old he was. Was he a little kid? Was he a young man? Was he a teenager? Was he even a little older? I don't think anybody knows for sure. It doesn't give his age. But to go through the experience of going up that mountain and knowing they were going to do a sacrifice and being old enough to carry the wood and to ask questions and to just have dad say, you know, God will provide. And the closer they get, and then they build the altar. And then Isaac's on the altar, and he's bound there. And the fire is about to happen, and the knife is about to be driven through him. And what kind of trauma is that for a young kid or a young man? So Isaac really, I think, I put in the title, Painful Honest Anticipation. I think he had a lot of pain in his life. I think some of us can relate to that. And he had some real hang-ups in the way he did life as a husband and a father. But he anticipated the future, and that's what Hebrews commends him for. He knows that the blessing is in the future. And let's face it, he, like his father, died without being able to count a bunch of descendants like was in the promise. In 23:1, Isaac's mother died, Sarah died, and Isaac was 37 years young at that point. And in chapter 24, when he was 40, you have the story of the way he got his wife. And culturally, it's all different back then. Isaac really had nothing to do with it. Abraham took his servant, made him promise certain things. Isaac can't have one of the local girls for a wife. He's got to go back to our own people. And she's got to meet certain requirements. And a lot of responsibility put on this servant. And then he said, and if you can't pull it off, then you're free from the oath. promise me that you'll do it right. And if you can't make it happen, if it doesn't come together, then you're free to come back without a wife. And you know the story of how he went there and they met Rebecca and quite a bit of drama as she recognized that she wanted to go with this servant to become Isaac's wife. And her family wanted to delay, and finally she got to go. And he got his wife at age 40. Rebecca enters the picture. That's his first 40 years. Quick summary of it. Chapter 25, verse 1 tells us that now that Sarah had died, Abraham married again, Keturah, and he had some more kids. And in chapter 25, verse 7, Abraham, Isaac's father, died at the age of 175. And it's very interesting that in 25:9 of Genesis, we're told that Abraham was buried by his sons, Isaac and Ishmael. Now, I'm guessing that they didn't have a lot of camaraderie between them during life, but isn't it interesting how death of a family member brings us back together? And that happens in the next generation as well, where Jacob and Esau had their issues, obviously. But when Isaac died, they came back together to bury him. And so now Abraham is out of the picture. In chapter 26 of Genesis, in my notes, I called it like father, like son. Isaac certainly must have been aware of his father Abraham in the journey of life where he twice, to protect his own life, subjected Sarah, his wife, to tremendous danger and subjected the plan of God to be in jeopardy. When Abraham said, "She's my sister, not my wife," and he did that to protect his own life. Once again, there's no doubt in my mind that when God leads us along on a journey, he's able to protect us. And when he makes a promise, he's able to fulfill it. So for Abraham to put the whole story in jeopardy to protect his own life is certainly very selfish. Well, in chapter 26, Isaac does a similar thing with Abimelech. And he tells him that Rebekah is his sister, not his wife. And then Abimelech catches them being kind of cozy with each other, Isaac and Rebekah. And he says, "I don't think she's your sister. I think she's your wife." So they work that whole thing out, and he goes on his way. Isn't it interesting how some of us can have all the information in the world about the people that lived ahead of us, and they share with us their stories, the things they did right, the things they did wrong. And so often we don't necessarily follow the things they did right, and we do follow the things they did wrong, and Isaac was no exception to that. Am I sounding weird all of a sudden? Okay, good, because it sounds weird to me, but usually when I'm talking to myself, I sound weird, so it's okay. In chapter 27, you come to this special place where you get a real good picture of what Isaac was like as a husband and a father. And it's kind of scary, really, when you read about it. Back in chapter 25 at verse 21, it says, Isaac prayed to the Lord on behalf of his wife. This is Genesis 25:21, because she was barren. And the Lord answered him, and Rebekah, his wife, conceived. Another thing that's so interesting about these early years of the Jewish nation, Sarah couldn't have children until she was old, and it was a miracle. And Rebekah couldn't have children, and so finally Isaac prayed for her, and the Lord answered. Jacob's going to have a similar problem with the wife that he really loved, Rachel. And so now Rebekah, in Genesis 25:21, finally is pregnant. But the children struggled together within her, and she said, "If it is so, why then am I this way?" So she went to inquire of the Lord. And the Lord said to her, "Two nations are in your womb, and two people shall be separated from your body. And one people shall be stronger than the other, and the older shall serve the younger. When her days to be delivered were fulfilled, behold, there were twins in her womb. Now the first came forth red all over like a hairy garment, and they named him Esau. And afterward his brother came forth with his hand holding on to Esau's heel. So his name was called Jacob, and Isaac was 60 years old when she gave birth to them. When the boys grew up, Esau became a skillful hunter, a man of the field, but Jacob was a peaceful man living in tents. I think the summary of that is that Esau was a daddy's boy and did outside things, and Jacob was a mama's boy and liked to work in the kitchen. Doesn't say it exactly that way, but I think it implies it. Verse 28, now Isaac loved Esau because he had a taste for game, but Rebekah loved Jacob. There's favoritism in that home, and that's never healthy. And when Jacob had cooked stew, Esau came in from the field, and he was famished. And Esau said to Jacob, please let me have a swallow of that red stuff there, for I am famished. Therefore his name was called Edom. But Jacob said, first sell me your birthright. And Esau said, behold, I'm about to die. So of what use then is the birthright to me? And Jacob said, first swear to me. So he swore to him and sold his birthright to Jacob. Then Jacob gave Esau bread and lentil stew, and he ate and drank and rose and went on his way. Then Esau despised his birthright. Now, I don't understand a lot about the birthright, though I know it has to do with inheritance. And I don't understand a lot about the blessing that's going to come a little bit later, though I know it had to do with God passing on a generational blessing from one generation to the next. But what I think is so interesting here as we look at Isaac's life is several things. One, he could be viewed as a passive dad and a passive husband. But part of that, too, was Rebekah was the one that got that message from God. And I respect her for that. She's the one that when the kids were kicking around in her womb, she went to the Lord to inquire what's going on here. And he said, you're going to have two kids and the older will serve the younger. And when they were finally born, the older came first, but Jacob came out hanging on to the older one's heel. And it was in Rebekah's mind, appropriately, that Jacob would be the one that would get the family blessing and would be in the line following Isaac. I don't think we can conclude anything different from that. And whether Isaac was ever communicated that information, I don't think we're told in our text. And so Isaac is in a tough spot because he maybe kind of a middle child syndrome. He's not the oldest. Generations of people will go strong leader, not so strong leader. Maybe himself kind of a mama's boy, grew up to be nearly 40 before his mom died. Somebody else finds his wife for him. All he had to do is wait for her to come, and she became his wife. Wouldn't that be a nice journey? You know, especially if you get a perfect one like I did. I would have been happy to have somebody else just pick up Carol and bring her into my life. But it doesn't work that way. And so Isaac seems kind of passive, and he seems kind of, the favoritism that he allowed. Never a good thing in a family. Never a good thing to have take place. And then Esau, you know, he's a young kid that's, he's hungry. And he's got short-range thinking. And so when he comes in hungry and Jacob has some food, and he says, you know, I'm going to die of hunger. What person in his spot is really going to die of hunger, you know? But he thought he was. That's a typical immature attitude. And he comes to Jacob, and Jacob plays on that. Jacob, by design, by nature, is a schemer. He's deceptive. His name means he's a supplanter. And it's part of his personality, and it's going to haunt him in the years of his life. And so he bargains with Esau, and he gets his birthright. And And whether that was a legal thing that he really got to where he would get the inheritance, I don't know how that could work, how boys could decide that. It seems like that's a parental thing. But in their mind, it was sealed, and Esau gave it to him. And so then you come to this situation where Isaac is an old man, and he's probably not going to live much longer. And it's the traditional thing to pass the family blessing off to the next generation. And obviously he will pass it off to Esau, the oldest son, the one who was born first when the twins arrived. And again, I don't understand a lot of this. And I can't help but wonder, didn't Rebecca ever tell Isaac what God told her? That the older will serve the younger? Didn't they ever communicate? Didn't they ever discuss the fact that somehow the blessing has to go to Jacob, not to Esau? Painful as that might be, and improper as it might appear. Are there couples on planet Earth today that have been married long enough to have kids and they don't communicate any better than that? Maybe. If that's the case, I think we should work on that. But it comes time for this blessing. And Isaac says to Esau, go out and do your hunt and fix me my favorite meal. They obviously had a thing between them that was very close. So Esau goes off to do his assignment. Rebecca apparently is doing her housework, and she's over close to the room where the area where Isaac is, and she hears this conversation, and she panics because you can't give the blessing to Esau. You got to give it to Jacob. And so whatever they did or didn't do, instead of having a conversation and a little prayer meeting between Isaac and Rebecca, how do we handle this thing? She simply teamed up with Jacob to lie to Isaac to give the blessing to Jacob. And they pull it off. They prepare the meal. They cover him with animal skin so he'll be hairy. And they make him smell like the outdoors. And Isaac can't see. His eyesight is terrible. And so he checks out Jacob, wonders how he did this thing so quickly. Checks him out, says it's the voice of Jacob, but everything else seems like it's Esau. And Jacob just follows right through on this thing and lies through his teeth. And Isaac blesses him. He gets the blessing. I think it's so interesting that he was supposed to get it, but not by deceit. And that's where I think this whole thing we can learn from Isaac and from Rebecca is that we don't need to try to help God do something that he can do by himself. I don't know how he would have changed that. I don't know how God would have fixed that problem. I don't know. But I know he would have. If you can trust God for anything, you can trust him to fulfill a promise. And obviously they didn't. And so they deceive Isaac into giving Jacob the blessing. And then Esau comes in. And when he comes in, he's not a happy camper. And he begs his father for some kind of a blessing. And his father finally gives him kind of a blessing, but it's not the one he really wanted to hear. And so then Esau goes out and he says, after dad dies, I'll murder Jacob. That'll take care of that. And he marries some more local girls, makes his parents unhappy. And finally, Isaac dies in chapter 35 at verse 28. And once again, Esau and Jacob are there for the burial. I think one of the key lessons that can come out of Isaac's life, two lessons. One is he reminds us that we don't have to help God do his work to get it done right. And especially, we don't need to become deceptive to try to make something happen that God probably is very capable of making happen on his own. And the other thing is, the statement out of Hebrews that Isaac blessed Jacob and Esau even regarding things to come. I think it was a painful, honest anticipation that Isaac had, that even though at his point in the journey there certainly weren't descendants like the stars of the sky or the sands of the seashore, but he did do what he needed to do, and he had faith to believe that God would finish what he would do as he passed the blessing on, and he's commended for it in Hebrews. Now, as some servers come down to join me, I want to talk just briefly about the Mount Moriah experience and tie it in with our communion service. In that day, God asked Abraham to do what I would call the impossible. Take your son, and it specifically says in chapter 22, your son, your only son. So obviously God wasn't including Ishmael in this line at all. And take him, and I'll show you where to go. Another one of those deals where you get the information as you walk. And sacrifice him. And Abraham did that. And you know the story of how they went on the journey, and then eventually they left the servant behind, and Isaac said, hey, we have the wood and the fire, but where's the sacrifice? And God said, or Abraham said, God will provide. And they go all the way up, all the way to the altar, to where Abraham is actually raising the knife to put it through his son. I don't know how a man could ever be asked to do that, and I don't know how a father could ever follow through on that. I get emotional every time I read that story, trying to identify with it. But it does show the faith of Abraham, and it shows the faithfulness of God. And the New Testament tells us that Abraham was convinced. At that point, he trusted God so much that he was convinced that God could bring Isaac back from the dead. And so in his heart, he was convinced that if he had to kill him, God would bring him back to life. As I've pondered this in preparation for today and knew that it was Communion Day, I thought, isn't it an amazing picture of Jesus and the Heavenly Father? And Jesus, who came to earth and walked the journey of life and walked the road to Calvary and literally carried the wood of the cross, and died. The absolute, unbelievable sacrifice for our sin. I think it's interesting, too, is it isn't his father that killed him. The Jews convinced the cruel Romans to kill him. And he died really because we killed him. Our sin demanded his death. If the story of Isaac as the potential sacrifice grabs our emotions, the story of Jesus, the for real sacrifice, should break our heart. It was our sin that put him on that cross and demanded his death. The ugliness of sin way too often is made not so ugly, sometimes almost attractive, almost funny. That should break our heart too. So as we ponder the communion this morning, the little piece of bread that represents Jesus' body, our sin was put on his body. That little cup of juice that represents his blood, the blood that washed away our sin. I invite all of us, join me in pondering the significance of why Jesus died and how it relates personally to us. And then to just be grateful that he did it, that he followed through. The sacrifice that was demanded to take away our sin. We'll be serving the bread and the cup together. You'll have plenty of time to hold them and to ponder. But let's pray. Father, I can't imagine the journey that Abraham and Isaac made up that mountain. And I can't begin to comprehend the power, the emotion of that afternoon when Jesus walked that road to Calvary, carrying his cross, and then hanging there, nailed, bleeding, dying, and saying to the Father, forgive these people. They don't know what they're doing. And he looked out through the course of time, and he saw humanity and saw millions of people that would benefit from his death and his burial and his resurrection. And he saw me. And he saw every person in this room that has trusted him. It's amazing. We ponder it. We believe it. We wonder how it could be. And it's a faith journey. By faith, we believe that Jesus is our God, our Savior. And we remember him in the symbols of the bread and the cup. And we thank you for him.